Pacifico, Phil Hendry.
And welcome back to the world-famous Phil Hendry Show. Every night till 1 o'clock on the West Coast and 4 a.m. on the East Coast, a news, talk, and entertainment show that knows what it's talking about, where truth is our bitch, and we go places other talk shows wish they could. They wish they had the living guts, but they don't, and that's okay, because, you know, if you can't. If you don't have the talent, if you don't have the execution, if you don't have the, if you're mentally, you know, stable, if you're not mentally ill, if you had a solid and supportive upbringing, if you had two parents that were home, if you had a mother that was stay at home, if you had a father that went out and worked in an honest profession, then you can't do the show that I do. I'm kidding.
Man, you ripped into your pants there.
What?
Yeah, what'd you say?
I said you ripped into your parents there.
No, I didn't. I'm just joking around. Well, you know how jokes are. I mean, they're part serious.
What kind of parents did you have anyway? People want to know about it.
You know what? You can find out if you listen to the Paul Gilmartin podcast, which is called the Mental Health Happy Hour. And he just interviewed me on his podcast, and I was very proud to be on it, too. And Paul talks to a lot of people in media about their upbringing, about their influences. He gets into some pretty interesting stuff. It's a very, very different, unique podcast, and I think you really like it. We have a podcast coming up that will be different and unique, and that will be happening in just a couple of weeks, debuting on Sunday, the Phil Hendry podcast. It'll be a week from this coming Sunday, the Phil Hendry podcast, and you'll be able to get over there and get a free downloadable version of Phil whenever you want us. We'll have some legacy stuff on there. We will have our current take on life, et cetera, et cetera, so on and so forth. It'll be the Phil Hendry podcast coming up in just a couple of weeks. But we are going to be featuring quite a bit of the legacy stuff. So I saw this here. I thought maybe y'all be interested in that.
What is it?
Well, top five regrets of the dying. Now, the only reason why I printed this off is because it was tweeted by a very funny guy and a cat that I know, Peter Serafinowicz, which I know is a really weird name to... Don't try to do it, bud.
Where is Peter?
Serafinowicz. He's very, very well-known comic actor in England and hell of a nice guy, and actually linked this story. It's from The Guardian. Top five regrets of the dying. A nurse has recorded the most common regrets... This kind of stuff is interesting. What happened to my glasses, man?
I think you left them upstairs.
That's great, man. I made a point of bringing them with me, and I left them upstairs. Anyway, not a problem. A nurse has recorded the most common regrets of the dying, and among the top ones is, quote, "I wish I hadn't worked so hard." What would your biggest regret be if this was your last day of life?
Mine would be...
Well, I haven't asked you guys yet, okay?
Yeah,
I know what mine is.
Will you hold on for a minute? I'm not interested in either one of you guys telling me what you regret. Gee, let me read this for a second.
Yeah, but I'm trying to think what mine would be.
No, really? Gee, I didn't know that. Hold on for a minute. There was no mention of more sex or bungee jumps. This is what this nurse found out. The nurse who did this informal sort of survey, because he or she worked. Her name is, Bronny. Is that a chick or is that a, let me see here. Caring for, is an Australian nurse who spent several years working. She. Okay. Whew. Man.
Yeah, a guy named Bronny. That sounds like it could be a guy, though.
It does. It sounds like it could be a guy's name. Bronny Ware is an Australian nurse who spent several years working in palliative care, caring for patients in the last 12 weeks of their lives. Like hospice care. There was no mention in the top regrets of the dying. There's no mention of having more sex. There was no mention of, more bungee jumps. This nurse who counseled the dying in their last days has revealed the most common regrets we have at the end of our lives. And among the top from men in particular was, "I wish I hadn't worked so hard." That one I get, you know.
Why?
Well, you work your ass off because you want to make money to protect your family, to take care of your family. You work your ass off because you want to get to a certain level. You want to get higher and higher up the chain of success so that you're making enough money where you are now able to afford a certain amount of freedom. And, I mean, I guess that's really what life is about if you want to get right down to it. For a lot of people, it's having the time having the freedom to do really whatever the hell it is you want to do, not get up in the morning and go to a job. So in order to do that, you got to work your ass off. And now at the end of their lives, people are saying, you know what, wasn't worth it.
Yeah, they'd rather just not have the time off even if they can't afford it.
Exactly. Have the time off even if they couldn't afford it. Bronnie Ware is an Australian nurse who spent several years working in palliative care, caring for patients in the last 12 weeks of their lives. She recorded their dying epiphanies in a blog called Inspiration and Chai.
That about tea?
Yeah, that's about tea. God.
What are you talking about?
Well, what are you... No, it's not about tea. It's kind of an I Ching kind of a deal, man. You know, I don't know.
What's that?
Well, chai, chi, I don't know. But it ain't about tea. If you think it's about chai tea, maybe it is about tea. I don't know. Which gathered so much attention that she put her observations into a book called The Top 5 Regrets of the Dying. Ware writes of the phenomenal clarity of vision that people gain at the end of their lives and how we might learn from their wisdom. When questioned about any regrets they had on anything they would do differently, she says common themes surfaced again and again. How about that?
So the people that died, they said the same thing?
She said common themes emerged, maybe not exactly the same thing. Here are the top 5 regrets of the dying as witnessed by Bronnie Ware in this book, The Top 5 Regrets. I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. That's the number one regret. How about that?
Boy, that's kind of unusual.
It's very... How did the American flag get behind me on our video cast? I will not have the American flag desecrated like that. The American flag only flies at the end of the show.
I didn't think you cared.
I do care. I don't want the American flag flying behind me like it's a prop. All right. Yeah, I wish I had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. This was the most common regret of all. When people realize that their life is almost over and they look back clearly on it, it is easy to see how many dreams have gone unfulfilled. Most people had not honored even a half of their dreams and had to die knowing that it was due to choices they'd made or not made. Health brings a freedom very few realize until they no longer have it. How about that?
Well, I mean, they didn't want to be married.
Well, it's not about not wanting to be married. It was more like if you're going to be married and you're going to have children, the best way to live is to be true to yourself. You want to obviously support your family and you want to support your children, but you should support them at a job maybe that you're happier at, you know? I don't know. I mean, I'm not, you know, these people, like she said, there's a clarity of vision. Number two, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. That's the one that we mentioned. This came from every male patient that she nursed. Every single one that she nursed, every male patient said, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. They missed their children's youth and their partner's companionship. Women also spoke of this regret. But as most were from an older generation, many of the female patients had not been breadwinners. All of the men I nursed deeply regretted spending so much of their lives on the treadmill of a work existence. Number three, I wish I'd had the courage to express my feelings. Now, what does that mean? It means, she says, many people suppress their feelings in order to keep peace with others. As a result, they settled for a mediocre existence and never became who they were truly capable of becoming. That is, oh, man, you got to have the guts to people, you know, we were talking about this before the show. As humans, if we're honest with ourselves, we always make fun of people who are different. And the reason why we make fun of people who are different is because deep down we know they've got more guts than we do. They've got more guts. They are gutsy enough to go out and be who they really are and not conform necessarily. And the first thing that the human beings, being what we are, the first thing we do, because we're pack animals and we're comfortable in the pack, like Dan was saying in the break, we want everybody to be in the pack. We don't like anybody stepping out. And so it's hard for us to be who we are, expressing who we are, you know.
Yeah, but that's about feelings.
It's the same thing, man. It's the same thing. All right, we're going to be back here on a world-famous Phil Hendry show. How many of these? Top five? Okay, we only got two more to go. So we'll be back with that and other items here on the agenda. The world-famous Phil Hendry show.
Truth is our bitch. The Phil Hendry show. world-famous Bill Hendry Show.
Style Cattle, what the guy done?
I'm going to tell you about it. Welcome back here. You know, last night we had a conversation, and it was about, what the hell was it about? Oh, yeah, it was about, in part, it was about John Edwards, and it was actually, most of it was about John Edwards, but in part, it was about the Mellon family. The Mellon family, M-E-L-L-O-N,
Watermelon.
Yeah.
You know, you did that joke five times last night. Tonight, that makes six. The watermelon family is not funny any longer. It was.
What about the honeydew melon?
Neither one of you guys. Now you're pissing me off because it looks like you're trying to piss me off.
So you are pissed off.
Yeah, and I'm going to start swinging. You want that?
No, sir.
You?
No.
Then just knock off, okay? The watermelon family.
Well, you laughed last night.
I laughed last night. That was last night when I laughed. Now I'm not laughing anymore at the watermelon family. It's the Andrew Mellon was the big granddaddy of them all. Andrew W. Mellon, who was an industrialist, this, that. You know who he was. He was the U.S. Secretary of Treasury. He was the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. He was a... He was really an amazing guy in terms of what he invested his money in. He was very, very keen and he was very smart the way he spread his money around. He seemed to know what the future of technology and industry would be in America. Made a lot of money. All right. So anyway, we find out that one of his descendants, is a lady by the name of Bunny Mellon, Rachel Bunny Mellon. And Bunny was a big John Edwards fan, so we started talking about Bunny Mellon, and that's what got us to Andrew, you know, back to Andrew.
Now, the way you said that sounded like we started out with Andrew, went to her, and then went back. Sorry.
So anyway, make a long story short, I said, well, this guy, Andrew Mellon, he was a member of something called the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club, whose earthen dam failed in May of 1889 and caused the Johnstown flood. Now, the Johnstown flood is considered to be one of the greatest disasters in the history of this country. It killed over 2,000 people. I think there are only two events in American history where the loss of life was greater. One of them was 9/11, and the other was, some other natural disaster in the early part of the century. I don't think Pearl Harbor, actually... The number of dead at Pearl Harbor exceeds the Johnstown flood. There was well over 2,000 killed, approaching maybe 3,000. But don't quote me on that. I could be wrong. But it was one of the biggest disasters. Basically, what happened was this. There had been a reservoir above this little town of Johnstown that was no longer in use. So it was taken over by a bunch of rich guys. And I'm not blaming the rich, but, you know, when you hear the story, it'll be kind of interesting. This was a reservoir that was no longer in use commercially, and so it was taken over by this South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club. If you look at a map of that area of Pennsylvania today, there is a town called South Fork. You see Johnstown. You also see a flood memorial. And you also see the stone bridge in Johnstown, which is where a catastrophe occurred because the floodwaters backed up on this bridge. And in the floodwaters was a lot of debris. And the debris that started to back up at that stone bridge, which today you can see, it's right off of a highway that cuts through Johnstown, caught fire.
How come?
It was in some way flammable. And there might have been gases of some kind that were somehow released by some of this debris. But now they had a fire on top of the floodwaters.
Yeah, but why didn't the water put it out?
Because there was so much debris, the debris is burning on top of the water. And on top of that, if it's any kind of an oil-based fire, the oil and water not mixing, the water's not going to do anything to it. So it was horrible. And there were dead bodies everywhere in all of this debris, and now it's on fire. So it's just, you can well imagine people in the year 1889, what the hell is this, man? It wasn't the first flood they'd ever had. So these guys that were up at this hunting club took over this reservoir, and they said, well, you know, this would be a nice place for us to, you know, we could stock it with fish, this and that. It was an earthen dam. And that means it was made of earth. It wasn't concrete. It wasn't made of wood. There wasn't it wasn't wood reinforced by some sort of caulking or cement. It was earth. It also had some runoff pipes, but because it was no longer a commercially used dam, nobody thought to, you know, to think that these pipes, these runoff pipes were needed. They were in disrepair. And so for about 9 years, these very wealthy men who were members of this hunt and fish club, one of them being Andrew Mellon, used this reservoir, dammed up by earth, as a place to fish, as a place to relax, yada, yada, yada. But they had pretty torrential rains in that area, and every year somebody would say, well, you know,
oh, so they knew that dam was going to give?
Well, you know, there was always some guy saying, you know, what are we going to do with this dam, man? You know, if the day ever comes, and so it wasn't a conversation that they hadn't had. Now comes the storm of 1889. It's in the month of May, I believe. One of the members of the club who lived in a cottage right at the dam gets up in the morning and he sees that the floodwaters, the dam waters, are now cresting. And he says, we're in big trouble now. He calls out other members. One of the engineers that was a member and also worked on the dam was called out. And these guys worked for a good 6-7 hours trying to dig runoff, trying to repair these pipes, trying everything they could to release the pressure that was building on this earthen dam. They knew it was going to give.
They barely knew.
They knew. They knew enough about this thing. And it's a great example of, you know how people say, well, why put off till, you know, that old saying, it's a kind of a turn of the phrase, why do today what you can put off till tomorrow, you know. You might as well get it done, because these guys knew there was something wrong with this. Now comes the day of reckoning, and man, there ain't no turning back, and they're trying to dig runoff. They're trying to get these pipes fixed. They're trying to do anything they can do. They were working their asses off, these guys, because they knew. They knew. If this thing breaks, man, we will never, you know, there's going to be hell to pay. And sure enough, they recognize there's nothing more we can do. They retired to high ground.
Why don't they keep on working?
There wasn't anything more they could do. The dam was going to give way. They left. They went to high ground. And sure enough, boom. And I think it was sometime in the early afternoon, this dam gave way and began this sort of torturous journey down this valley, taking out little villages, taking out homes, killing people, taking out, in one instance, it almost took out a railroad train. There was a guy sitting in a locomotive who threw it into reverse, if you're ready for this. He tied down the steam whistle and threw the thing into reverse, basically warning everybody behind him with this whistle, you know.
So the whistling's going fast?
He's going as fast as his ass can go in this steam locomotive backwards down this rail line with a whistle going like bloody hell, telling people to get the hell out of the way. And eventually the water's caught up to his locomotive, lifting this thing off the tracks. The man lived, I think his name was Hess. John Hess was his name. He was the engineer. He did live, and lived to tell about it, and it was a very courageous thing to do, trying to warn people. But the waters eventually hit Johnstown, slammed into this stone bridge where they caught fire. All of this debris caught fire. And it was brutal, man. There was, like I said, close to 3,000 people dead. You know, it was years before they had this thing all cleaned up. But here's the thing about that dam. As the result of that dam breaking, the lawsuits commenced. And it became a part of liability law from that day forward. And you can look this up, that you could sue an entity as opposed to individuals. You could sue the entity, and they did. They wound up suing the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club, saying they had the liability here. They caused this by not maintaining that dam, by not, you know, doing whatever due diligence they should have been doing to maintain the integrity of that dam. It burst, and they sued the club in total, which means they were able to sue all the members.
But up to that time, they had to sue one guy?
Yeah, because up to that time, you would find one guy. Who's the guy that's responsible here? Well, I don't know. We're all members of the same club. Well, I got to find one guy to sue. Well, then they just boom, man. And that became a if you'll pardon the expression, a watershed event in American legal history. World famous Phil Hendry Show. We'll be right back.
That's great history, Mr. Hendry.
Thank you.
Phil Hendry.
Phil, 877-876-7445. We're going to bring on a guest that we have on from time to time, but we never really talk with him about the actual area of expertise that he is employed in as a professor, as well as a astronomer at the Mountain Meadow Observatory in Colorado. That is Dr. Ron Tarner, who also does teaching at the University of Denver, and joins us tonight to talk about this story that is really interesting, and you have a completely unique view of this thing, and that is the mining of asteroids by all of these millionaires, the Google brass, and I think Ross Perot is involved in this. Do you know the story well? What do you think?
Well, Phil, first of all, thank you. It's always great to be on with you.
Good to have you, Ron. We haven't had you on in a while.
Well, first of all, I think you may be interested in my read on this.
I let me just interrupt you for a minute.
Sure.
Let me tell people, give people some background here.
That's important. I know that Larry Page is involved and Eric Schmidt.
Right. Google CEO and chairman, his CEO Larry Page, chairman Eric Schmidt, are among the backers of a venture to mine asteroids for trillions of dollars of precious metals as Earth's resources become strained. Seattle's Planetary Resources aims to launch a telescopic space surveyor into Earth's low orbit in less than 2 years to identify potential metal and water-rich asteroids and then begin prospecting within 4 years, according to co-founder Eric Anderson in a telephone interview. The venture, which would be the first effort to mine the solar system commercially, has the backing of billionaire Ross Perot, Google board member Kavitark Sharam.
I believe it's Kavitark Ram Shararam, as well as Charles Simonier and Page and Schmidt. So it's obviously a very moneyed group of men. But here's what I find deeply disturbing, and not only is it disturbing, Phil, but it's you want to sort of involve yourself in this effort to make sure that you're not being taken advantage of.
What do you mean?
Well, these men have said they want to mine asteroids for precious metals. Precious metals. Those precious metals would be obviously gold. Obviously, they would in some instances involve silver. Obviously, copper. Any metal that fetches, when you say precious, you're talking about a metal that is in rare supply. Is a low supply, is a rarely occurring metal on Earth. That's why gold is so valuable, because it rarely occurs here on Earth. So what they're saying is they want to corner the market on rare metals, and we here on Earth sit and applaud them as if they're doing something for the human race. I think it's very. If I wasn't so insulted, I would applaud them myself.
So you are saying that these men, Larry Page, Ross Perot,
all of them, are engaged in a self-enriching project that they've gotten a whole bunch of attention for. There's nothing in this news announcement that says, well, once they begin mining these asteroids for precious metals, what are they going to do, turn them over to the banks of America? This obviously would be the beginning of cornering the market of these kind of asteroid metals, these precious metals that are mined on asteroids or planetoids. That certainly would seem much more feasible to mine them on a planetoid than on an asteroid.
But you say asteroid.
I didn't say asteroid. I said, who is that?
Bud Dickman. Let me ask the questions, Bud. Asteroids, right?
Yes, I said asteroid.
I'm sorry, so this is Robert Leonard?
Yes, sir.
It sounded like when you said asteroid, he thought you were talking about a hemorrhoid.
No, I'm not talking about hemorrhoids. Is he listening to what I'm saying?
Well, you said asteroid.
I did not say asteroid.
Right, would you guys just let me ask the questions? He said asteroid, okay? So, that's a very interesting take.
Oh, yeah. I haven't heard anybody say anything about it.
So, in other words, the partnership of these men that would see asteroids mined for their precious metals is just simply a project to corner a certain precious metal market by these guys, and they're getting all this publicity, but what's the benefit to the human race?
Well, I think that it's a fair question. Before anyone gets too excited and we start blanking each other's blanks, as the Wolf said in Pulp Fiction, if you remember the Wolf saying that, Phil?
Yes, I remember the Wolf saying what you said.
All right, let's not start blanking each other's blanks just yet.
No, he said, let's not start.
Let me talk to the guy. I don't need you saying it.
Yeah, well, that's what he's going to say, but I say blank.
Right.
So before we start blanking each other's blanks, let's take a look at this and recognize it for what it is. And that is these men mining these planetoid or these asteroids or what have you for the precious metal.
All right, now, ripping up the Earth's, and maybe this is what you mean when you say that there's a little bit of a con job going on here, because they immediately begin talking about the Earth's environment.
Well, exactly. You started the phrase there, Phil. Ripping up the Earth's crust not only is terribly intrusive from an environmental point of view, but it's actually really expensive and really hard. So this man, Anderson, Eric Anderson, who's the co-founder of this project, is talking, oh, it's intrusive. He doesn't care. He's using that as an excuse so that if they need funding or anything that they may need to go into outer space and buy these asteroids, they'll get, because they look like they're being philanthropic.
What do you think?
In
the sense of, first of all, is it possible?
Well, anything is possible, as we like to say in science. What we are seeing are more and more private interests learning from the experience of NASA and learning from the experience of the Russians and the Japanese and the British and any other country that has ventured into space. We find that now commercial interests, private interests, are learning the lessons very well. They recognize and understand the construction of vehicles that would be that would go into Earth orbit, and how to construct it, obviously, efficiently design and put into use a vehicle such as that. Also, what it takes to stay alive in space. What we don't know is how to mine asteroids. And this is where I think you will see, unless they are careful, you're going to see an accident the likes of which would make the most horrible thing you saw in Armageddon, Deep Impact, or 2001 seem like child's play. And
good Lord.
That's what I would expect. And
you're saying if these guys attempt to, because it hasn't been done before.
Well, there's never been any attempt to mine anything in space. And these men are going to go up there, big heroes, you know, as they like to say. And it will be something what was the name of that movie the guy came back and his skin changed, and I'm not saying that that'll happen.
Quartermass?
Yes, the Quartermass experiment.
What do you mean?
What do I mean? You want me to spell it out? You get guys that are fooling around in space, and one of them comes back and his hand has turned into a tree trunk.
What's he talking about?
Oh, get out of it. What, Doc? Come on.
No, what do you mean, Doc? Come on.
Well, what are you talking about, man? These guys go into outer space like anybody else.
Oh, yeah, like anybody else. No one has mined.
All right, nobody has mined an asteroid before. I understand that. No one's mined a planetoid. No one has gone to the moon and done any of that. This would be the first, when you talk about what's a first. But all of a sudden you have these guys mutating into trees. I mean,
I didn't say tree. I said his arm looked like a tree trunk. What he eventually became was far more horrifying. You know,
Okay, so what are we doing? Are we joking around with science fiction?
No, we're not joking around with that. What I'm trying to tell you is when you take private citizens and they monkey around in space, horrible things occur. Horrible. And I mean horrible.
Okay, what is our experience with that?
What is our experience with what?
What is our experience with private citizens going into space and, quote-unquote, monkeying around in space?
I just got the quarterback. Well, all right, it was a movie.
Yeah, it was a movie. Give me something real.
Well,
can't really find anything real, but I mean, a quartermaster come close.
Well, what, are you guys high on something tonight? Or what do you mean the quartermaster? That's a movie.
But I mean, what I was saying was, all right, what about 20 million miles from Earth? Okay, that was a movie.
Yeah, that was a movie, 20 million miles from Earth. I want something real, something that has happened, something in our experience as a human animal, that private citizens have gone into space and returned having mutated into trees. There is nothing, okay? So you're worried about something that is strictly science fiction.
Well, Phil, let me tell you something. You just got done talking about that dam giving way. If someone had worried about that, there'd be about 3,000 people alive today. Well, they wouldn't be alive today. They would have been alive then. Okay?
They'd be alive then. They'd be dead now.
I know they'd be dead now. But they, if...
There would have been 3,000 lives saved, put it that way.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
All right, I'll put it that way. There would have been 3,000 lives saved if someone had taken care to predict certain things. I've tried to tell you and your listeners that we have an opportunity. If we send private citizens into space and they come back gibbering like animals, like mindless things. I want us to think of everything very clearly. That's all.
Well, you've got an imagination on you, man. You know.
Well, you know what? I can only echo what David G. Hall said. Okay, man.
You know what? I'll talk any way I want. Compared to you, I sound like the most normal guy on Earth.
What does that mean?
What it means is, you're talking about mutations in space. You're talking about 20 million miles from Earth. You're talking about the quarter mass experiment. You're talking about all of this jazz that hasn't ever happened, that probably won't ever happen. And you're saying it will. It's possible because you have civilians, quote, monkeying around in space, drilling planetoids and this and that.
Drilling who?
Yeah, what did you say, drilling who?
Yeah, what does that mean?
Drilling planetoids. Put him on hold. We'll be right back. The world-famous Phil Hendry Show. Did you put him on hold?
Yeah.
I don't want to hear him popping up again, okay?
No, he's on hold.
World-famous Phil Hendry Show.
What do you mean about planetoid?
So you lied to me.
No, I'm just kidding.
You lied to me. We'll be right back. Phil Hendry Show. Please
Truth
don't hurt me.
Truth is our bitch. The Phil Hendry Show.
What do you mean about planetoid? No, seriously.
Yes, David.
Well, I'm sorry you're back.
Yeah, I'm back. What?
Well, I'm sorry to keep bothering you, Phil. You had a jelly. Dr. Turner just called me and said you hung up on him, too.
Yeah, I did.
So that's, I don't know how many guests, six guests, you hung up on five.
That's right.
Why'd you hang up on this guy?
Oh, because he was talking about humans coming back from space travel having morphed into blobs and, you know, space creatures. Because he was talking about the Google effort to mine asteroids, and he said that civilians that go up there and try mining or doing anything in outer space run the risk of coming back as mutated things, okay? So, in other words, the guy's just given me the plot line of every 1950s sci-fi, and I just said goodbye.
Well, do you know this guy to be nuts?
I don't know him to be nuts.
Well, what is he?
He's a little extreme. He's a very eccentric guy. He's got a problem with Stephen Hawking.
Oh.
Yeah, that's the guy that
thinks Stephen Hawking's a racist.
Oh, this is the guy that thinks Hawking is does all those Polish jokes.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got a problem with Stephen Hawking. His problem with Stephen Hawking isn't so much that he claims Stephen Hawking does Polish jokes and he just does racist. He says that Hawking, excuse me, is always looking to score chicks.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, nothing wrong with that if that's the truth, but this cat's obsessed.
So this guy's obsessed with how often Hawking gets laid? You gotta be kidding me.
Yeah, you might bet that guy getting obsessed about a guy. Like, guy's all a human pretzel.
He's worried about how the human pretzel gets laid, huh? Well,
what do you mean the human? Let's have a little respect, okay?
Oh, okay. Sorry, sorry, Mother Cabrini. You know,
well, I mean, you called me up, all right?
Yeah, well, I'm talking about this guy. What's his name? Turner called me up.
So you're on his side.
I didn't say I was on his side.
But you're just referring to Stephen Hawking as the human pretzel.
When did you all of a sudden become a Hawking fan?
I'm a fan of his the way a lot of people are. The man's a brilliant man. He's gone through a lot. I do not begrudge him anything. And I don't see what this has got to do with Ron Turner, who is on my show tonight.
Yeah, talking about how he'd morph into some kind of a thing.
Right. Now, you can say what you want about Stephen Hawking, but when he publishes a paper or talks about science or is involved in any discussion having to do with human... this guy is talking about stuff that we can understand, from the planet Earth.
And this guy Turner's talking about,
The Blob and like that.
All right, I'll let him down easy. I got him on hold on the other line. He's very angry. And
I don't give a damn,
All right, do you want this guy back on your show?
Here's what I want. Every time I got a guest that gets upset, do you need to call me on the air about it?
Well, excuse me.
Yeah,
God.
Excuse me.
Well,
Wow, I mean, all he's doing is trying to help.
Bud, why don't you shut up, licking his rear end?
God, I mean, all I was trying to do... And what do you mean, licking my rear end?
Yeah, he says I'm a rear licker.
You are.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
Well, I mean, I'm just calling up. I just wanted to know what's...
You've called me 3 times tonight. Talking to, hey, why'd you hang up on this person? Why'd you hang up on that person?
Well, why have him on the show if you're going to hang up on him?
Because I like it. It feels good. Okay?
Phil, you call this guy Turner nuts. You sound like you're not the brightest crayon in the box either. So
you know what? You know all about me, the brightest crayon in the box. You know what's wrong with me and what's right with me, so...
Yeah, that's what worries me. Now go ahead, hang up on me.
Oh, okay. Goodbye.
Wait a minute, I was only...
You did hang up on him.
He asked me to. And since I've been doing it so much tonight, since I have been, pissing him off tonight with all of the hang-ups. All right. Thank you, David Hall. Sorry about that, sir. Dr. Turner. And, good luck to you, man. Whew. Unreal.
Did I buy those precious metals?
Yeah, I had. Thank you, Robert, for reminding me. The precious metals that they're talking about are not only gold and silver, but what they say is the following: what these would be space miners would do is, after surveying and identifying precious metal deposits such as platinum in near Earth asteroids, phase 3 of the company's plan is resource extraction, for which it will develop robotic technology.
Well, Tony, they're not going to have a guy do it.
No, they're not going to have a guy do it. No, so we won't see, maybe we will see the, remember that ship in Alien?
Yeah, Alien?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about it?
That was a mining ship.
It was?
Yeah, the ship in Alien, remember they were coming back with I don't know how many tons of ore that they'd gotten off a planet? And they were coming back with this ore.
So so they probably had a robot.
Well, they must have done some kind of robotics or something, because there's only a crew of, unless the miners are back on the planet, so I don't know, but...
Yeah, but that Star Trek that one time, where the guy, he's a miner too.
Yeah, but they were using those creatures, the Ordas. You remember them?
Oh, yeah, they looked like a rock.
Yeah, they looked like rocks, but they were living creatures, and they bored through the rock. They would eat this, I think they were silicone creatures. I don't know anything, so...
Yeah, why'd you bring that up?
Because you guys are asking me about whether they're going to have miners or robots. They're using robots.
Yeah, but they said they're going to use robots.
Every day I get closer, bud. Every day I get closer.
To what?
To belting you. Every day I draw a little bit closer. Nearer to thee, Lord. Nearer to thee.
Cut it out.
The world-famous Phil Hendry Show is produced by Phil Hendry and Dan Northcraft. Join us online at philhendryshow.com. That's philhendryshow.com for a live streaming video of our show, as well as all of our wonderful archives, our daily podcast, our classic Phil podcasts, and of course, don't forget our souvenir shop, which is just chock full of all of that groovy Phil Hendry stuff. All right? Catch you guys tonight. Until then, let that be a lesson to you. It's good luck now. I like it.
Phil Hendry.